This podcast is in partnership with Design Biennale Rotterdam, Phoenix Museum, Lack of Guidance, Margreet Olsthoorn, New Institute and Rotterdam Partners, as they all share the common goal to create awareness, share opinions and empower creative growth.
Story of my life, always trying to feel this freedom of being, not being able because I was so distracted, and running became self-medication. What's maturity? I don't know, because sometimes someone of 28 can be much more mature than someone of 48, you know. What do you want for yourself? And think about that. Unfortunately, among hypersensitive people, talented people, the highs and lows are bigger.
In this episode, Abdelkader Benali shares his thoughts on the importance of mental well-being, finding balance in a demanding creative career, and using self-reflection as a tool for growth. He uses storytelling as a passion and a therapeutic outlet, helping him connect more deeply with himself and his readers. Join us for an honest conversation on creativity, mental health, and the journey to self-acceptance. Hello, good day, Abdelkader Benali.
Hello, Bastiaan.
How are you doing?
I'm doing okay, thank you.
Can you describe a little bit where we are today?
Yeah, you are in my house in Amsterdam, a suburb of Amsterdam, and this is where I live. It's an apartment, and it overlooks the Slotoplas Lake. It's not a real lake. Pond. Small pond, and it's in a green area of Amsterdam. Very much like to live here. I've been here living now for 5 years with my wife and two daughters.
How's life treating you at the moment?
Good. Life is good. It's busy. A lot of things on the table. A lot of works to do. A lot of things to do. I'm going to publish a new novel in January, so I'm now busy with galleys, reading. Before it will be sent to the printing, before it will be printed. Yeah.
Does it ever give you a little bit of stress or excitement when there's a new book because you have done over 100?
Yeah, I it's not out of my control. It's being read by people. People comment on it. I like that. I'm also very relieved. It's out of my
control.
Yeah, no. I'm done with it because I've been working on it for 2 years very intensely with a lot of passion and sweat, and now it can go to the public, and that's a nice something that I'm looking out to.
The reason why I ask is the profession of a writer is or seems to be quite a difficult one. Because you're on your own, you have to motivate yourself, you have to get all the stories from yourself. And we know a lot of Dutch writers who are not among us anymore. You described this as well in another interview. And that's also why I invited you, because you're also very much on education for children and youngsters, teenagers, etc., up till whoever wants or needs it.
Yeah.
Can you describe a little bit what it is that you do apart from what we all see?
Yeah, well, I'm a kind of jack of all trades. That's how I like to call myself. I make theater, I make television programs, I'm doing documentary making. I'm kind of ambassador, advisory board kind of jobs I have in the cultural field, but also in the field of education. I'm very much into education lately, very much into closing the gap between have and have nots, and how education can contribute to that. I'm very much involved in that discussion because this is something I see in society. I see that education is good in our country, but education has a lot of problems to solve for a lot of children. It's not only about educating, but it's also about upbringing, about creating possibilities for children, and that's something very exciting that I'm involved in. I'm making a theater show with theater company in Rotterdam called Hotel Modern, which is about history and suppressed histories in Europe. So, you know, I like to be this free agent. You know, I like to be a free agent. I like to be following my instinct, following my ideas, and getting into interesting collaborations with people from where I can learn also. I'm also very much into learning from an experience, learning from a collaboration. I don't want to be the kind of guy that's always repeating himself, you know, because that I'm 48 now, and you, at a certain age, you become at that, in a zone where you have to, really have to think, am I going to repeat this for the next 25 years, or I'm going, and I'm, from a young age, I was the kind of guy, kind of person that really likes to do new things, new frontiers. Also because that's where my ideas are. That's where I discover what I really want to tell, what the urgency is. So for me, doing this is also a kind of necessity.
How important is reflection for you?
Well, I like to reflect with people. I don't like to reflect on my own. I like to read books, which is, of course, a way of reflecting. I want to, you know, for me, books and fiction, nonfiction are kind of touchstone. But then comes the, you know, the debate, the talking about it. And I'm very much into going out, seeing people, being in contact, doing things, and also see if we can formulate new ideas for the near future, you know, because I'm a creative, you know. So for me, it's not about repeating, but it's much more about, let's see if we can formulate new ideas or new ways of seeing. I like that very much.
Yeah, and a lot of people admire you for this for a couple of decades. But you mentioned now, before you gave your answer, that you don't like to reflect on yourself. Is there a special reason for that?
Well, that's a good observation. I mean, there's not much to reflect on myself. I mean, I can reflect on myself, but it's not something that gives me insight in new things, or that I go deeper. I like to talk with people. I like to ask questions. I like to be out of myself to become a better person. So I really need the other. You know, I need the other, and I need a new context or new contact or new endeavor to make those steps in fulfilling my ambitions.
Mm-hmm. Would it be possible for you to be for a couple of months alone in your place without?
I could be perfectly alone.
Okay.
Yeah. And I also know, I can also be alone among the people. I know how to shut things down. I can work on myself. There's no problem at all. For me, being alone is not a big thing. A writer is in a way always alone, because he's, you know, you're so much involved in a story, and you carry a story with you for sometimes a year, 2 years, sometimes 20 years. No one knows about the story, just you. You're working on it, you know. You know, you're working on a story for a longer period. No one knows about it. Even my wife doesn't know what I'm working on, you know. And my editor knows something about it. And then so there's also a form of solitude. So as a writer, you know how to create this space. But the thing is, it's not that I can be lonely with myself, because I have these ideas in myself to chew on and to work on, and you know, and I like to observe, and I like to be. The thing is, I don't want to be isolated. You know, I don't want to be put out of the group. That's something else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you say, no, I'm going to isolate you, you know, you don't have access to information, you don't have access to people, you don't have access to life. Yeah, then I will be dead within a week, because that's the human, you know, the animal needs its surrounding to thrive and to grow. Yeah.
Yeah, because some people I interviewed, they mentioned that they need to travel the world or the country to be alive and not to be stuck at home.
Yeah. You know, I can be at home and still be very restless, you know. So I can journey in my room. You know, I can travel in my room. Because I have books, I have poetry, I have music, I have ideas. I like to travel. You know, I go frequently to Morocco. I also need going to Tangier, the city where I live part of the year, to relax and to see things from a different perspective. But this whole imperative of that I have to be on the go has become less urgent through the years.
You also mentioned that you started doing running early on,
yeah,
just to cope up with the feelings of depression and such. I think this is very valuable for people to hear from you, because everyone sees you as in, wow.
Yeah.
So there's a whole
difference. So the whole thing is that I recently found out that I have a severe ADHD, HD, I think it's English, or ADD. I found out that I you know, all those, the symptoms of ADHD, I can apply them to myself. So distracted, hyper-focus, impulsivity, sometimes also, dreamlike states, all those things. And I've been like this from very young on, but I've never recognized it as such. People would say to me, "Hey, look, you're ADHD. And I would say, that's a joke. I'm super focused. I'm very concentrated. Then a couple of weeks ago, I read an article by an actor, Thomas von Laan, who talks about this. He did his coming out as ADHD. I read the article, and I know this guy. I know him as an actor, as a humorist. And I was very impressed by his lucidity. I was very impressed by his vulnerability that he showed in his article. And I was like, wow, this is me. The way he's talking about it, and especially one thing, he says at a certain point, he says, my inability to really be in the present leads to a depression when I'm disconnecting with other people. And then I was like, oh my God, this is me. I can be so caught up in my dreamlike state, in my hyper-focus, in my highs and lows, that people cannot connect with me anymore. And that leads to depression. And you feel that the depression is killing you. The bottom line of the article was this. And I was like, yeah, this is what happens to me. I have two daughters. I am an example to them. And I see my ADHD in them. I see that they are also restless because they look at me. And that frightened me so much. That I was like, oh my God. Oh, I don't want this. I don't want them to be like me. So restless, so not able to be, not able to feel this freedom of being, which is, so I was reading this article and I started doing some soul searching through books. I bought a book and I bought another book. And I found out it's actually like, story of my life, that I've been going ups and downs and always trying to feel this freedom of being, but not being able, because I was so distracted. And then we come back to the running. Running became self-medication from a very early age. Running, for me, is a way of being. It's feeling the freedom of being again. Like writing can feel like that, like poetry, like theater can feel like that. But the running was a kind of, when I touched bottom as a student, running became really the only way for me to be able to exhale again and to feel kind of freedom of being. The running became a kind of way of relaxation, but it became also a form of setting new limits, because I started doing 10Ks and 5Ks and half marathons and eventually marathons.
2.5 hours.
2.5 hours. No, 2 hours, 43 minutes is my personal best, which is, makes me one of the fastest writers in the world. so I'm good at it, and it also gave me kind of pride, like, wow, I'm proud because I can do this. I can suffer. I can run. I like running. I like also to suffer in running. I don't like to suffer in life, but I like to suffer in running. And the outcome of it is very positive, because you have these great, running times. But the dark side of it, is that part of it was self-medication, and now I'm 48 and I'm discovering that I'm really, really heavy ADHD, to extent that I can be sometimes very distracted, not out of lack of respect for the other, but just because in my mind things happen that I cannot control, that I'm not at ease with. I can also feel ashamed of them. But I'm very happy that I recognize it. I'm very happy that through this article and through the books I'm reading now, that in that sense, has come kind of, you know, calm over me, like, oh, I know what it is, you know, so I can tackle this. And I also see that ADHD has given me a lot of things. It has given me this life I'm living, you know, it has given me this production that I'm eating the fruits of, you know. So it also has a very positive side. My children, they're very talented and playful and imaginative in their own way, and it's a joy to see. So I'm not, you know, I'm not going to give ADHD super bad press in that sense, but it is something for me I have to deal with, because I want to grow. You know, I don't want to feel that I'm limited by it. You know, and that's what I felt at a certain point, that I was so much doing things and being, the engine was like running, but I didn't know how to stop the engine. No, and one of the things of ADHD is that you feel that you're like a motor, but you don't know where the off switch is, you know, and that's where I'm now at.
And does it also physically take a lot of energy?
No, physically, no, nothing. It's like I sleep well and I eat well, but it's just that I'm so fast in my head. It's like storm. It's always super restless. I cannot switch off my head. And, you know, my wife says this to me. They sometimes say, oh, it's better that you go away for a couple of days, because then there's a kind of calm in the house. Because there's always, you know, your presence is always like on. And I'm like, oh.
And how is this now? At this moment, during this,
I just started like this journey. So
no, but now between us.
Well, now it's like I have hyper focus. You know, I just have hyper focus, and which is great, because you know what you're talking about. You know, when you have hyper focus, you focus, you concentrate. I'm in the moment.
Yeah.
But the moment this will stop, I will be in another. I will have another hyperfocus, which is also kind of escape thing, because just being in a hyperfocus kind of escape from reality, escape from being, of feeling the freedom of being, you know. Why this is, well, you know, this has to do with the youth and upbringing and connections, and, you know, I think also migration plays a big role, but it's like the background noise to this story.
And then, at 28, you won the Libris Literature Award.
Yeah.
Have you ever thought, I didn't want to win this award?
Well, in a certain way, it came as such a big surprise to me, winning it, and I was so overwhelmed by it. I was very young, and I just started, you know, yeah. and then that happened, and it, I also got into depression.
Because one of the quotes that I saw was, you were now among the greatest in writing.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, don't believe the hype, you know. Mm-hmm. Especially when you're an artist or writer, you know, you make things, you share them, and you carry on. The moment you start believing the hype, which is great, success. I mean, the biggest curse is success. I mean, failure is great for an artist, because from failure, that's where, you know, where the magic happens, you know, because failure is not a quality, it's a quantity. And you have to fix it. And fixing it is the process. It's great. Success is like the idea of perfection, and the idea of it's finished. It's the idea of subliminal, you know, it's there. And that blocks everything in a way. I mean, it blocked me for many, many years. Like, I just couldn't do anything without thinking about, I didn't think it through. I didn't think that through. I didn't think through what success is. I didn't think through.
You're quite young as well.
Yeah, I was very young, and nobody could tell me how. No, but there was no one who could tell me how. There was no one who, in a way, it was very difficult for me to explain that I did not feel happy because of the happiness. That the happiness did not make me happy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I get it. You know, it doesn't make me happy. Of course, I was selling a lot of books, but still, in my heart, it was like very, very difficult to feel happy about.
It, at the beginning of the interview.
Because you see me talking and I'm, but in a way, but this just blocked all the energy in me. It just put big, like a wall, and it blocked my energy. So for many years, I couldn't be in contact with myself, let alone with the other, because there was this wall I had to deal with.
At the beginning of the interview, I referred to other writers and yourself as a profession, and that it's quite a hard one. This is one of the very best examples I think you could give about success and then meeting up to expectations of yourself, the outer world. How did you overcome these obstacles, and what can others learn from maybe not to have access?
I can now be an advisor on that, a kind of coach, because but it's very personal. That's first of all, it's very personal. There's no one size fits all.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about finding the intimacy with yourself. That's something that's your own personal journey, and no one can write down how that will look like. So there's freedom there. But also anxiety. I was very young, and I found tranquility in love, just having a relationship that put a lot of things on hold. Just having someone who was there for me, and who was not judging, or where I felt comfortable and safe and happy, and we just started doing normal things. I think secondly, what's very important is, go look for professional help. It can be books, it can be a psyche, it can be a coach, but look for professional help. Give it to yourself, give yourself some attention, especially when you think that the world does not comprehend you, especially when you think that something is not going good and no one, you feel isolated, you feel anxiety. Make that step to look for someone you can talk to, a professional, not an amateur, not a friend, not a family, because they love you, and they cannot really help you. This is very stupid to say, but when someone loves you,
they're too close.
It's too close. Yeah, it's too close, and there's too much forgiving in that sense. But you need a professional person who has seen things before. I think it's important.
Did you have one?
No, I didn't. And also, I was too. I just couldn't make that step. That's also. I was very young, and I didn't really know about it.
Different times.
I didn't know what it was. ADHD, ADHD. I didn't know anything. And also, I was like too busy with a lot of other things. The success and everything. But it isn't really. And the thing is that I was doing things, but I felt unhappy in the end. And I was blaming myself. I was saying, but it's because of you. You're not living up to expectations, blah, blah, blah. And then it becomes a kind of mantra. And also because what happened was I started repeating all these thoughts all the time. I was becoming really, how do you call it, this like a neurosis, all the time the same thing, repeating him as kind of almost like a cassette tape that is repeating the same sentences.
Were you ever scared?
Yes, of course I was scared, but I was also laughing because I was running and I was having a great time. I was doing travels. I mean, it's not that something that, but sometimes I would be really paralyzed by anxiety, and then I didn't look for help. I didn't look for help, and it's that's I think you and what is help? Help is really opening up a dialogue about yourself with someone. I think that's very important because you have to take it serious, and you have to work on it seriously. We call it in Dutch, je moet jezelf gunnen. You have to give it to yourself, especially when you're in a field with a lot of pressure, a lot of responsibilities, especially when things are going well and are very positive and things are looking very progressing, but you still feel anxiety you feel uncomfortable with your happiness, then you should really see someone and talk about it.
I still have many, many questions. But let's do some positive things.
Yeah. Well, this is positive.
It's positive as in the advice, but for you as well in the podcast.
Yeah.
Let's go to the other side, because you're a mentor directly or indirectly to many.
Yeah.
And you also made the book Droommakers. Thank you for such a book.
Yeah.
Can you explain a little bit what it is and why?
Well, the starting point is I've been involved a couple of years ago into general discussion about inequality in society and how does that reflect in our educational system. So we have schools. If all those kids from disenfranchised communities that come in, poor families, refugee families, migrant families, go to school and that are living the inequality in school, and what can you do as a school about that? What can you do as a teacher? As a board, as a system to gap the inequality, to give those kids opportunities, to create opportunities, and to create perspective, and to create love for life, freedom of being. How do you reach your audience? You know, how do you reach this audience of young people with this all these amazing gifts and talents and capacity to learn? I was thinking about these questions, and I wanted to see with my own eyes, as kind of journalist, or how does this work out in schools themselves? How do teachers, managers on a daily basis cope with these issues? So, and I reached out to Hans Spekman. He's the director. He's an old politician, Labour Party, and now he's the director of the Jeugdeducatiefonds. The Jeugdeducatiefonds is an organization that gives money to schools that is being used to gap the inequality. So it can be a language, it can be extra money for language, it can be extra money for culture, it can be extra money to visit a musical, it can be extra money to have some extra attention, etc., etc. So they cover more than 700 schools, primary schools. And I told him, I said, could I? And I was having this dialogue with him, I was meeting him up, and he would talk about his work very passionately. He would talk about what he saw on these schools, how kids were treated, how did they come to school, how did they go to school, how did they start school. He would talk about kids that go to school with hunger, you know, with no food in the belly. He would talk about kids that don't even have a sleeping place, that don't have a bed, that don't even have a mattress to sleep on. He would talk about kids that... That would like go to musical, and that for the first time in their life they would be in a bus, you know. And I was like, "Whoa, this is heavy stories, you know. I want to know more about it." And then the idea developed of making a book in which I would visit these, not all these schools, but 17 of these schools. 15 of them are in the book, and I would just talk
throughout the whole country.
Yes, throughout the whole country. Yeah, from north, because also this, the whole issue of inequality, we talk about it most in Holland from the point of view of the big cities, but actually it's something that you will find everywhere in the whole country. It's of course predominantly bigger in big cities because bigger population, and demographically it's more diverse, but it's also in the small cities and in what we call the provinces. It's there, and it's something that educators and teachers and managers on a daily basis are putting an effort to overcome this, and the examples I saw were very impressive and can teach us something, not only us as parents and as educators, but can also teach society something about how do we give young people a perspective and on life, how do we give them a positive attitude, how do we teach them, how to give them those values that can help them to overcome obstacles. And they also, and the kids themselves, they are also like inspiring me and us, you know, to be a little bit more less pessimistic and a bit more optimistic about society.
Half of the time you're in the Netherlands and otherwise in Morocco, you describe yourself as a storyteller and an observer, for instance. If you made such a book, you saw the education of this, and you go to Morocco, do you only relax and fuel yourself to come back again and do things in the Netherlands? Or do you also intend already to take the knowledge and do it there?
Well, I've done some projects in Morocco. I go there in the first place just, you know, to feel this freedom of being. Bicultural. Morocco is my bonus country, I call it. I really like to be there. And also, it's also kind of self-medication, you know, because we live in the West, we live in Europe, and we live a crazy life. You know, really, it's fast lane here. It's like really fast lane. And because we're so much into the fast lane, we don't even feel anymore how fast lane it is. It's really crazy. You know, look at our life, you know, working our head off. And I mean, the energy is good. I mean, it's all positive, but it's still fast lane. Then I go to Morocco. It's Mediterranean, Atlantic. And then the pace of life is slower. It's really much slower because it's less industrialized. It's less commercialized. It's also less structured. And there is more space. As you see, that generally in the Mediterranean countries, there's more space for family life, there's more space for friendships, there's more space of cultivation of the public space. You know, you go out to the park, you sit in the park, you sit in the, you know, the greenery, you just use also the public space in a much more, let's say, freedom-loving way, because the days are longer, there's more light. That's my medicine. So when I go there, I really like the slower pace of life because I fit into it. I also become a bit slower, and that's also makes my life better. You know, the quality of life goes up. And I take that energy back with me. So I'm very happy for that. And also I like to be there with my kids and share with them Moroccan patrimony, Moroccan life, you know, to give them also, when it comes to identity building, a bit of that. And they like it, which I'm very happy for. You know, they also want to go to Dubai on vacation.
Fast lane.
They want to, you know, they're like, but we're still okay. And I do some projects there from time to time, yeah.
But do you also invest in education, or do you see the need, or do such?
Yeah, well, that's interesting.
Because you're talking about closing gaps.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I just, this book and also my involvement in education is also very, very much about all the kids in Holland should get the education they need, they deserve. And the book and also my public speaking is also about saying, you know, we should give those children, our generation, these kids, the education they deserve. They need better education. They need better education. So it's in a way, I am not an activist, but I'm very passionate about it. I saw all those kids and I was like, really, you really deserve the best of the best because you're so talented and you need to be seen. You need to be seen and in Holland, also in Morocco, of course, but Morocco for me is not, you know, if I really want to change things there, I have to live there. You know, I have to have skin in the game, you know, but I'm in Holland. This is where I can really contribute. And we have these children from Ukraine and from the Middle East and from Eritrea and then we have teachers who, you know, in a very short period, accommodate them and make them feel safe. They're traumatized. And teach them the language and teach them also, you know, give them this feeling that you belong and you're welcome. Well, I find that incredible. I'm very much impressed by that.
Can you also, apart from how many books you sell, measure in any way the impact that you have?
Well, the impact that I have is very. That will come back to the connection you make with people. We can only make an impact if we are surrounded and if we create bonds with other people that can make impact. On your own, you cannot make impact. There's no way that I can make impact with just a book because it doesn't work that way. In democratic societies, you know. But if someone reads the book and is inspired by it, you know, it can be a teacher, a parent, educator, and starts reaching out to you, and then we have the dialogue going on. And then we can create impact. And you can always say, you just need one person to start a revolution, to start a new... why is that? Because I also do readings on high schools and as a writer, and I write about literature. And then the teachers, they put me in the class, the Dutch language class, and I do 1 hour. And then people always say to me, yeah, those pubers, you know, young adults, they're so bored, they're so, they don't like books and they don't read anymore, and you know, and what are you doing there anyway? You know, how can you reach them? I said, well, it's very easy to reach them because young people, the great thing of young people is that they, when they feel there's something at stake, there's something important, when they feel you are involved, then they are involved too. There's no, you cannot, you know, they cannot, so you have, really have to bring your personal emotion engagement. And when they feel that, then they listen. And then I also tell them, look, there's a class of 20 people. If I can convince one person in the class that culture is a greater good for everyone, then I am a winner. Because I only need one. I don't need 20 writers. I don't need 20 of them to become a writer. I don't need 20 of them to start reading all my books. I don't need 20 of them to unlight the flame of culture. That has never been like that in human history. Just one, maybe a half. If of the group of 100, sometimes I reach hundreds in one day, I have to do 4 or 5 classes, and there are 100 of them. And they're not, they're kids who like sports, kids who like math, kids who don't like anything, kids who are, you know. But if one of those young people is inspired by me, then it's so great. It's only one, it's a big thing. If one say, whoa, I like this, this is mine. I wanted to be a lawyer, I wanted to be a doctor, but now I want to do something in the creative field because that energy is also my energy. Then you have succeeded like splendidly. You only need one, you know. If you can, because 10 of them want to be a lawyer, 10 of them want to be a doctor. I mean, how many doctors do we need? You know, how many lawyers do we need? But we need a good politician. We need a good speaker. We need a good writer, a good theater maker. And that's something, and that, like the passion of the heart, is something always that connects with the heart, not with the brain. You know, it goes through the heart. And we don't know, you know, you don't need much, you know, you don't need a million actors. You know, you just need one.
Is there someone who eventually came to you and said, well, many years ago, I heard your speech?
Yes, of course.
And they made a bigger difference than
many. Yeah, many. The thing is that some people, like some young people, they follow me now for years. They come to my reading and then they say to me, you know, you came to my school, la, 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 then and then and then. I'm like, no, so I totally forgot, sorry. I said, yeah, and then they say, you know, it was very important. And they don't say it was very important for me, but you see, you know, that it really did something. And I think all right, everyone who has all stood for a class and can, you know, can relate to this. Because young people they're quite intelligent, and they think with their heart. They have to think with the heart because the head is a mess. You know, I don't know how about you, but when I was a puber, young adult, you know, my head was a mess. It was soup, you know, like so, minestrone soup. But you think with your heart, and that's amazing.
So when you were in front of the class, you mentioned in your childhood books helped you overcome insecurity.
Yeah.
Do you still have these feelings of insecurity? And is this something that you talk about with these children?
Yeah. Well, we also have to talk about education and how education should be more, how the classroom is it's an entity in itself. And when I come to the classroom, I'm very insecure because I have to do the magic in 1 hour. You know, I cannot build a relationship with the class. And the class is a group of individuals. There is no such thing as a class. That's my first thing. There's no such thing as a group. There's no such thing. There's individuals. The moment you look at the class or a group as a group, then the group will react as a group. But the moment you bring the energy of I'm here and I see you as an individual or I'm not going to judge you as a group, then the group reacts to that. Then you already won in a way. You already won the contact. You're already in contact. So yes, but that took me a lot of years to understand that principle. Took me a lot of years. I was sweating. I was very afraid. I could, especially with young people, young, the, you know, high school classes. because they didn't choose for you. You know, they didn't buy a ticket for you. You know, they you're stuck with them, and they're stuck with you. But the moment I understood that there's no class, and the moment I also understood one thing very important, I bring my responsibility, I bring my story, but the class or the group brings also its own responsibility and its own energy. And that energy can be very structured, but that energy can also be very, very crazy. Because it's individuals, you know, and they're having interaction and a lot of things happen. What can you do as a speaker or as a writer is, one, you can say, I don't want that energy because it's too much. And I'm going to do it my way anyway. And then I'm happy if I get out of it alive. But what you can also do is say yes to the energy. Yes to the craziness. Yes to the jazz. I call it jazz. You know, I love jazz music. And jazz improvisation is very important. It's where the beauty is. And I think we should be more aware of the incredible amount of energy and talent that the group has. Its ability to create jazz and to grow through jazz and to be in the present through jazz. And the moment you can embrace that, you can be open to that, then you can also become part of the combo, of the jazz combo. Then you start making music together. Instead of, you know, I'm sending and you're giving me, you know, your highly appreciated listening. And this is the energy I bring to the table when I go into classroom. And the classroom intuitively understands that. The class, even the naughty boys and the naughty girls, because that's also something interesting, how naughty and strong-willed those girls can be and quite... Then those start also being part of the dialogue with you. The ones that are like nihilistic or cynical about anyone talking can open up. I'm not saying it always works, because that's also, you have to deal with it. I can have a bad day. They can have a bad day. We all have our responsibility. There's no such thing as perfection, like in jazz, which is good, you know, And that's how I like to work.
I grew up with you. My generation did. Do they know you? High school generation?
No, at all. They don't know anything. No. Which
so
is good.
Yeah. So it's, you're quite anonymous.
I'm quite anonymous. Yeah. No. I mean, we live in different times. Every generation has its own heroes, which is great.
Is it also nice to be anonymous for a moment?
It's great. It's good. I have no time to be grumpy about that. It's so nice to see those young people, how open they are, and how they connect in their own way.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. It's really amazing. I also see that they are creatives, and you know, they use social media, they use media, you know, at large,
mm-hmm.
in a way that we could only dream of. You know, we had to use the fax machine. You know, to send an article, an editor would call you. I would talk like 1 hour, you know, about, you know, the editing. Now they use AI and ChatGPT, and it's amazing. And they use it so. Yeah, I like the energy.
What do you consider your biggest personal achievement outside of your career?
Well, it's like having two daughters. It's not my personal achievement. I mean, there was some biological process involved to get them where they are now. But the whole idea of being a father and being there for them is quite a struggle. Because we talked about this, you know, ADHD, you know, the fact that I can be, you know, I cannot be there. You know, I'm somewhere else. I'm not with them. I'm not feeling this freedom of being. But that we still, what I like at the moment, you give them attention and you can be with them. Then the reward is so overwhelming. You know, you just feel that you're connecting. That's, for me, that's something very, very, very important. It's like mm-hmm. the basis.
Yeah, because
of relationship.
Yeah, because I saw a documentary about your father and you and the relationship from early on.
Yeah.
And that you mentioned that the first time you actually became father you felt that there was recognition from you.
Exactly, exactly. It was very special because my father and I, we you know, there was always something, you know, like competition going on, you know, and some kind of hierarchy. And then I became father quite late, 37. And 37, not 38 or 39 even. And then my father was so, he looked at my daughter, Amber. You know, we brought her to the house and he looked at her and then looked at me and it was so soft. So I was so impressed by it, by the softness of the father. And then I felt like we were like equal, you know. And that was a game changer, sure.
What changed?
Well, the relationship changed because he suddenly, I was a son and now he saw me as a father. So he said, now you have, you know, now you know the shit I'm going through, or you will know the shit I'm going through. Now my shit is your shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think there was also something of that in that too, you know, like now you will know. Mm. Now you will understand why I was who I am, you know. Yeah, I think it's true. I think with Amber and Hannah, when we were having just the daily plight of being as a father, then I said, oh, wow, my parents did this too, but they did it on very difficult circumstances in a very difficult time. Also uprooted, you know, by migration. And I said, wow, it's quite impressive then that they came sane, that they came healthy out of the process. Or I don't think you come healthy out of the process. But anyway, that they managed more or less to mm-hmm. to give us, to feed us and food us and even have some, you know, and even give us love, you know, which is not easy.
Yeah, because there's a little bit more to the story that you mentioned now. As in, you grew up in Rotterdam. Your father was an owner of a butcher's
farm.
You are the oldest of the children.
Yep.
You were expected to take over.
Well, I wasn't expected because I worked in the butcher for a very long time from a very young age, and you know, I think for him it was a way also to discipline me, but also a way to, you know, not to need to hire someone. You know, your family company, it's something. I mean, later on, I've been reading and meeting people who also were brought up in a family business, and we can relate to that. We understand so well the shenanigans and difficulties of a family business. It's like it doesn't matter if it's a family business, it's like two persons or like 20,000 persons. The same, because you work together, you live together, you wake up together. Yeah, there's shared responsibility. It's sooner or later it will lead to a lot of pain.
Yes, and your sister mentioned that it was nice to see you in the store, but you were for sure not a butcher.
No, I mean, I was good at it and everything, but I was also like reading a lot and doing theater, and I was dreaming a lot of, getting out of it a lot. I was really dreaming, was thinking, if I stay here, I will become mad. You know, I cannot do this. I mean, I like the work. It's not something, but I want to do something else.
Mm-hmm. What would you say to people who are in a position where they feel their expectations, but your heart says differently?
Yes, it's a very good one. I think those people already know. They already know which decision to make.
Mm-hmm.
They only need an excuse. You know, and the excuse cannot come from inside in a way. Excuse should come from outside. You know, you should become depressed or sick or something happens. And then that's a sign. That's a sign. It's very strange because people who are unhappy with that expectations, they already know. They have been knowing that for 10 years. They know it the day they started. The day you started that work and you feel that it cannot click, then you knew. You already knew intuitively for you. But then you hold up because it's good income, or maybe you think I can grow into it, or I can outgrow it. But at a certain point, you know, you will get this this feeling of, okay, this is it. I cannot go on like this.
Is there something that you can give as a tip? Because
I'm very much into the in there's no size that fits all. It's very, very personal. Very, very personal. You have to look for information, look for good books, look for good YouTube stories, you know, podcasts. Feed yourself and be sincere. But everyone is sincere because no one can lie to himself. No one. There's no one. I believe also in something like, you know, I like at a certain point, the science will tell you what to do. It's very strange, but there will be a sign. It can be a little thing. You know, I'm not talking about extra, you know, magical things, but just that you suddenly sit somewhere and you're eating and then suddenly you see someone and he or she reminds you of the person you were. And then something happens in you, starts working. That's a sign. Because we are human beings, we are very able in not seeing the signs, you know, till we see them. You know, like me with ADHD, I saw the signs like for 30 years, my friend. When I was a student in Leiden, I already knew something is wrong. Why is this happening to me? Why do people say I'm intelligent, but I feel stupid? Why do people say you're concentrated, but I feel distracted? And then I read an article on a Saturday afternoon and a couple of weeks ago, and it's like, this is it. I finally am where I should be. This is a sign. And I'm also able now to make the necessary steps. What is the sign? The sign is that article, those symptoms, they remind me not only of myself, but also of my daughter. I'm like, oh, shit. Yeah. Okay, so it's something that's intergenerational. You can go give it to the next generation. Hey, wow, responsibility. What am I going to do with this? Abdelkader, do something about it.
What are you going to do about it?
Just, well, what I'm, you know, I'm reading and I'm also, I will is sooner or later go to and talk to someone, look for a psychologist, just sit down and talk and give myself that space. To communicate it, a professional, read more books and enjoy the ride, you know, and also enjoy it, you know, not something I want to suffer, but look, oh, I can do something about it. Because I felt 20 years ago, I felt helpless. I felt, oh, I cannot do anything about it. I felt this despair and anxiety. But now it's different. Now it's more like, oh, I can do something about it. I can become, I can maybe arrive at a certain position. Maybe with medicine, without, I don't know, it doesn't matter. Just you wanna grow, you wanna go there.
Could you have thought these things when you were 30, for instance?
I think I already thought them, but I was so anyway lonely or not in connection that I would just put them away because there was too much anxiety. You know, and I didn't read the signs. I couldn't read the signs in that.
Well, basically focusing on the fact that you say I have the challenges, I see that I want to enjoy the ride, although it's not it's process. Because for someone who is much younger and they're so in the middle, without life experience,
exactly. So it's because I'm also in contact, of course, with. You know, I do some coaching for people, but not coaching, just talk to people. And I see people and younger people. And then I tell the person, hey, I see that you're doing this and this and this. It's great, but to me it looks like ADHD. Maybe you should read a book. Maybe you should stop and consider something because you're doing so many things and you're very talented. But at a certain point, you will hit rock bottom And then we have this talk, this conversation, which is open and it's not about, you know, you should do this or that. Because if someone at that age told me you should do this or that, I would say, who are you to tell me this? You know, because anxiety was so deep and also, you know, what's maturity? I don't know, because sometimes someone of 28 can be much more mature than someone of 48, you know. So that nothing to do with age. It's more about what do you want it to be for yourself, and think about that. So that's a kind of there has to be some bit of struggle there, you know. If there's no struggle there, there's no pain there, and there's no real struggle.
No pain, no gain.
No pain, no gain. Yeah.
Do you feel responsible for this generation and the next?
Well, not really, to tell you the truth, because no one made me responsible for them, so thank you very much. But what I like to be inspired by them. I like to be able to contribute and to help and to play my role in that. And that's happening at the moment, so I'm not, in that way, have enough to do. So I think as again, you, it only works a responsibility, and it only works a commitment when you can really feel that you're in contact with the people you can really help, that are really needy, and also can give you something back into that, can also inspire you. It's not about giving, and then you feel happy. It's much better, or for me, it's when there's sometimes a little bit of a struggle involved, sometimes a little bit of chagrin, as I call it, a little bit of, you know, like, okay, what's going on here? Then, for me, growth is possible.
Can you name someone who inspires you a lot or has done in the past, which actually made quite a difference for you?
Yeah, well, that's a good one. I mean, there's so many people. I mean, look now. Like, let's talk about now, because I'm now working with theater makers on a new play, theater company in Rotterdam. It's called Hotel Modern. It's experimental theater, and they make beautiful. They work with puppets and animation, and now I'm working with them. So I'm in repetition. We're working together. Like, we work 6-7 hours. And what I like, what inspires me so much, is that you can really create something out of nothing. You create a safe space, you know, we're in the space, and just we sit and we have coffee, and then we talk. We talk for an hour, sometimes for 2 hours, we just talk about everything. And then you go to the floor and you start working on something with together. And at the end of the day, you have something. You have created something together. This way of working connects also with talking to the class, creating this moment of jazz. It's great, because then you're really into something. Then you're doing something with each other. You work with each other. You listen to each other. You try again. You feel better. And at the end of the day, you carry that with you home. And you think about it, and then you go back again, and then you do it again. And what I like of them is that they are so committed. I like that very much. I like committed people. My God, it can be a shoemaker, it can be a tailor, it can be a cook, it can be. I like committed people. Oh my God! I like when people are committed to something outside of themselves. If I want to say something to young people, because we're so self-absorbed, of course, we live in a time of like narcissistic. Overkill, look for commitment. When you feel you're really committed to something, when you feel it and it feels in your heart that you feel committed, then you're home. Then you don't need anything else. You don't need money. Money will come. You don't need attention. Attention will come. You don't need responsibility. Responsibility will come easily. But find commitment. If you're committed, then you can be like me. Take everything away from me, accept my commitment, and tomorrow I will build a house. Give me everything, but take commitment away from me, and I will be a beggar in the street. The commitment is core. I mean, I think that sums up really commitment. Young people, they go crazy on commitment. Old people understand commitment. So essential to everything you do. If you cannot have commitment, then I know a friend of mine, for my wife, she had a very good job at the Zuidas Financial District of Amsterdam as a lawyer. She made money coming in. She stopped at work beautiful woman stopped it, said, I cannot do it anymore. I'm going to do something else. And it was all about commitment. I was like, oh, wow. That's really skin in the game. You know, yes, two kids. And, you know, you have a mortgage, pay everything. I said, I cannot do it. And why? Because she was like, she came to a dead end because she didn't feel commitment. When commitment dies, everything dies. Point. When it comes to climate change, when it comes to, you know, economy, when it comes to, when people don't feel commitment, then you cannot work. You first work on your commitment and look for people who have commitment. It doesn't matter what that person does. He can be a cook, he can be a tailor, he can be a gardener. It doesn't matter. It's not about the thing. It's about learn from the commitment people show. It's slow. It's very slow. It's very it's deep. It's something that comes naturally. It creates its own space, and that's where the magic happens. And I like to see that when I see people with commitment, and I'm very lucky because I'm in the cultural field, and the cultural field is 100% commitment. There's no one who goes into culture for money or for prestige or for ego. Of course, we like success. But you cannot survive a single day without the commitment. It isn't possible. And I think that's something that you know, apart from the ADHD, and that commitment keeps me going. It's a commitment which is the best self-medication. And I like to see that. I like to see that, you know, can be a painter or someone who makes the road, you know, who's fixing the road. When I see someone working, you can see it. It's something you can see. You can just say to them, I'm going to see who's working with commitment with that. You know, that person who's working with commitment, he will become the CEO of the business, of the company in the long run.
You mentioned being in theater and that those people inspire you. And at the beginning of this explanation, you mentioned that you create a safe space.
Yeah.
How do you know that space is safe?
Because it's a space where I can really feel very empty and feel very like insecure, but still have hope that something beautiful can come out of it.
I'm referring a little bit more to how do you know that the people feel safe? Because you're a public figure. I'm not quite starstruck. I feel very comfortable here.
Yeah.
But I can imagine that if Abdelkader Benali walks into a room, for some people, it can be a different ballgame in a certain moment, and that they won't actually say to you,
I don't know if that really happens, because it's all about, you know, being yourself. You know, I think when you come into a place and you have expectations, yeah, then things can go wrong in seeing each other. But if you just go to a place and you just, you know, you just be who you are, then everything will be all right, as Bob Marley said. You know, I have met people who were very, like, you know, I would be starstruck if they come in, and then when I found out they were just being themselves, that already made a big difference. You know, because you also, I think it's true, you also have responsibility in this. You know, when you come to a place where people are really looking forward to see you, where they can be a little bit intimidated, you also have a responsibility to be nice, to be welcoming, and to be hospitable to people. To be aware that people can maybe react differently. And the only way to tackle that is just be, stay close to your commitment, and let that do the work. And I think that's also something that comes with the territory. You learn that, you know, you learn to be, and also, like, you know, I'm a human being. You know, I'm not a computer. I'm not a robot. I can also have a bad day. I can have a lot of bad days. I know this. And I express this too. You know, I say this, you know, I say to people, you know, guys, I'm now with my head somewhere else. Because my mother's on the line for some medication, you know, and that takes my attention away. Or, guys, I have something in my personal sphere, and it's normal. And people, when you can be open about that to people, people are also open about That's very good.
You mentioned the article that you read 2 weeks ago about the Hector opening up.
Yeah.
The only question that I wanted to ask is, you seem to make a, or is it stepping into a new phase a little bit?
Yeah.
Like now, the clarity and such.
Yeah.
How does this change trajectory for the coming time, and how is the conversation with your partner, for instance?
Yeah, well, that's interesting, because we both have our own life path and our own struggles and our own expectations, and now this is on the table, and I'm very happy to share this with her. You know, I'm like very happy to talk about this, and I'm also very happy to connect on this, because I also see why she sees me in a way. You know, there is something that makes her tired of me, or sometimes irritated, and it's good that I know this. You know, that, oh yeah, of course I can be pain in the ass, and I can be very, very difficult person to deal with, and I can be so demanding. It comes from somewhere, and you should be aware of it. And okay, good that I know this, because I've been very frustrated about a lot of confrontations, like, why is this not going the right way, and why are we here, not here, you know, and then something suddenly happened, and I lost control of it, and why is this? And now, through these articles and books, and also thinking back at soul searching, oh my God, this is what it is.
Is this also a journey that you, because it's now 2 weeks, if I'm correct?
Yeah, it's
that you both feel like dynamics change a bit, and that the conversation.
I hope so. I think it will change a lot of. I think it will change really also our relationship with the children, how you talk to them and how you be with them, freedom of being. Yeah, it's like, oh wow, I know where it comes from, because the thing is, the difference is, I always wanted the things to be good, but they didn't happen for some reason I didn't know about. I was doing my best, you know. There's this Arab expression that says, the bad is in the stomach of the good. You know, sometimes by really striving to do good, something bad happens. Why is that? Because you don't know what's driving you to do good. And the moment you know that what's driving you to do good, you also understand that drive can make people crazy. So think about that, and that's a good thing. Step back. Already the stepping back and just looking at it is quite nice, because then you create space. And let's talk about the young generation, or already being able to step back from yourself and say, doesn't matter if it's good or bad, but just look at about what's the cause of it. Why is it happening? Why I'm trying to be good for you and you're angry at me? Why is it happening? Just look at it, you know, from a little bit more distant standpoint, with warmth, of course, not from anxiety, but just try to understand yourself. That already helps. That already creates space for the other to breathe in a way. It's very, very, yeah. But and also, again, we're all human beings. We have temperaments. We have, there's a lot of anger, you know. There's a lot of frustration. It's normal. I mean, you are robots, and we also need a little bit of anger, you know, to go further. You know, we need that. You know, you need the motor. You need to understand your own anger, and when you understand your own anger, then you also will also understand your own anxieties. And when you understand your own anxieties, this will also be something to talk about with people around you. And that's really something I'm looking forward to.
If now I'm excited.
Now, you know, I'm now like, you know, everywhere I come now, and I feel a little bit of anxiety, say, it's HDHD, it's HDHD, you know, I'm, you know, this is me, you know, sorry, but this is me. And then people are like, oh, wow, you know, you're already giving the diagnosis, good, yeah.
So there's a new chapter, maybe?
Yeah, there's a new, yeah, chapters, but it's some...
Phase.
Yeah, it's phase, a new phase, yeah, new phase, new recognition, yeah.
Do you have dreams?
Well, dreams are plenty. But the dream is... Most of the the dream is something which is really about very practical. Like sometimes I'm like, I want to try a new recipe. I like food. I like cooking. So I'm dreaming of that. Like I want to try that. Or sometimes I'm dreaming of like doing a 10K race in a certain time. And I'm dreaming about it very intensely. Like I'm visualizing the race itself. Sometimes I'm dreaming about doing a theater performance, like because this theater production will go to premiere in March. And I'm dreaming about it, like visualization.
And long term?
Long term, it's more like, oh, you know, see your kids grow and do nice things with, you know, and have a nice time.
Yeah, because basically you do...
Because the books, and I'm not dreaming about doing new books, because books will come. It's not something I don't need to dream about.
Yeah, but that's coming back again to the writers and the profession and the people who are not among us anymore. Saying that the books will come, there are also many of these stories that they stepped out of life because the stories weren't coming.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I understand. Yeah. Yeah, but it's always, I mean, suicide is also multiple causes. Just
of course, yeah.
You know, I didn't make my deadline. I want to die. You know, it's romantic, but it's not. There's always much more involved. Much more involved, and it's a very interesting topic to talk about. But when you're sick, you're sick. That's also something. You know, that's why I'm always telling. Saying, look for a professional. When you're sick, like emotionally sick, if emotionally you feel mentally sick, there's nothing romantic about that. Sometimes you need medicine. Sometimes you need rest. Sometimes you need talk, but you need to look for a professional. So even, and especially people who are into the, you know, in culture, artistic, they're hypersensitive. I'm hypersensitive. We feel more, so we suffer more. But there's nothing romantic about that, you know, that's because we also have families, we have a partner, you know, we can hurt and we can be hurt. That's something you, and unfortunately, among hypersensitive people, talented people, the highs and lows are the extremes are bigger, and some of the extremes can lead to the most extreme position, which is death by suicide.
What do you want to be remembered by? Last question.
My God, what if I have no idea about that now. Well, I think more multitudes, you know, the idea of the multitude, the idea that you can indeed give expression to life through writing. That can still be a very important tool, to create understanding and empathy and insight in each other. Yeah, but that's quite, I mean, that's really a bit abstract, but in the end, you want to be remembered by the people around you. Let's bring it to that. I mean, I really like the fact that the people I love me.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
That was my conversation with Abdelkader Ben Ali. His openness about struggles with HDSD and depression offers a powerful reminder that mental health challenges are part of the human experience, even for those who appear successful. Abdelkader shared how writing became a means to process emotions, face self-doubt, and find healing through self-expression. His words encourage us all to prioritize mental well-being, seek healthy professional when needed, and embrace the journey towards self-acceptance, one step at a time. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to click the follow button, rate the podcast, subscribe to the newsletter, and spread the word so we can continue to grow the Don't Waste Eye podcast. And remember, everyone struggles, and that's okay. But standing still prevents you from growing and reaching your potential. Keep moving forward, because the better you become, the more you'll inspire others. Don't waste your time, don't waste your eye.